That's the Soul Jazz Orchestra out of Ottawa, Canada, with People People. It's from their 2008 album, Manifesto. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, November the 26th, and for the second day, Ferguson, Missouri is rocked by protest over a grand jury's decision not to indict Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown on August the 9th. Governor Jay Nixon has ordered an additional 1,500 National Guard troops to the 700 already there in Ferguson, which he has placed under martial law. But the protests continue and way beyond the geographic boundaries of the small city. Solidarity protests are now active in about 100 cities and towns across the nation. Today on Lead Stories, we follow up on yesterday's discussion, looking in particular at other legal issues that are still pending and whether the outcome of the grand jury's probe is going to be a harbinger for what's to come in another police-involved killing in the case of Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York, the chokehold death of Eric Garner. So we'll be talking about that as well. And I want to welcome once again our legal guide and expert, attorney at law, Alton Maddox Jr. He's with us, and thank you so much, Alton, for being with us again today.
And again, thank you very much for the invitation, Eutrice.
Not at all. One thing is, I just want to remark as we get off to this discussion, it seems everybody is reporting as if this is a done deal, including Eric Holder himself, the U.S. Attorney General, seems to say that, well, the grand jury's decision has been made, and let's move on.
Well, you know, I don't know what law school they went to, but the law school that I started, which was the University of Georgia, introduced me to the case of Scott versus Sandiford. And one of my law professors there asked me the first relevant question that I thought should have been asked of all black law students in law school, and that is whether I thought that I was a citizen of the United States. And after asking the question, he then did a preemptive strike and answered his own question by informing me that I was absolutely not a citizen of the United States and that I would never be a citizen of the United States, and that that decision had been decided in 1857 in Dred Scott, who came out of Missouri. And so now, as we see Dred Scott decision and then followed by the Civil War, in which black people really went to war themselves because of that issue. Now, white people went to war for other reasons, but the reason why blacks joined the military was because of Taney's decision that they would never, under any circumstances, be citizens of the United States. And so after having put that investment in America over that period of time, they were outraged, and part of the outrage was led by Frederick Douglass, who just simply could not accept the notion. And after dealing with Lincoln and et cetera and demonstrating to him why it was necessary for black troops to be brought into the Civil War and how black troops could save the Union, Lincoln was convinced then that he should give that a shot, because Lincoln himself was losing with his generals in the Civil War. And so it is interesting today that as we see protests all over the nation, we who have an appreciation of history understand why that is happening, because Dred Scott has struck once again, and now we are seeing a new civil war started in this country.
Well, certainly the point that you made yesterday was that there are legal remedies that still exist that can force a revisit of this grand jury's proceeding because it did not come up with an indictment. There are other ways to pursue justice there. That doesn't mean that the grand jury's decision is by any means final. I want to talk about before we get into some specifics here, because I know you have a particular menu for us today, but could we talk a bit about the pending federal trial, which will be on civil rights grounds, if it does come to a trial? But I wanted to ask about the threshold of culpability there, which seems to be a bit trickier, whereas on the state level, it's about looking for a preponderance of evidence, a probability. In the federal trial, they would have to show, or a federal action, they will have to show that the officer, Darren Wilson, had an intention to deprive Michael Brown of his civil rights. Does that not make it a little bit more complicated to arrive at an indictment?
Well, you know, one of the things I want to do in answering that question, Eutrice, is to introduce our people to the notion of thinking around concepts. Too many times, we have our opinions, which is based on our emotions, but very seldom do people actually go back to the law itself and look at the legal concepts and then lead from there. Now, the overriding legal concepts here is judicial review. That's the overriding legal concept. Now, judicial review is written throughout the criminal justice process. And initially, at the beginning, before the trial starts, lawyers make motions, in terms of the grand jury or the jury and how it has been composed and selected. And if there are substantial grounds, the judge can absolutely dismiss that grand jury, a petit jury, a grand jury, and start afresh. Once the trial starts, you make an opening statement, the other side make an opening statement, and then you make another motion at that stage where you say, well, in his opening statement, he failed to mention all the elements of what he was going to prove, and therefore the opening statement is defective. And at that point, if that is true, the judge would dismiss at that point. When the trial starts, once the prosecution finishes its case, the defense attorney will stand up and make a motion for, in New York, a trial order of dismissal. And so in that application, the defense lawyer will point out the prosecution failed to meet its burden of proof by not offering evidence on one or more of these elements of a cause of action. And if the judge denies that, the defense may offer a defense. And at the end of all of the case, the defense attorney would then make a motion to dismiss based on the fact that the trial record still does not support a cause of action. And if that is not granted, the case will go to the jury. And then at that point, the lawyer will say, if his client gets convicted, well, I move to set aside the verdict. And so if that application is denied, then there will be an appeal and there will be continued judicial review. The point I'm making is that there has not ever been any judicial review of any stage of the investigation of Michael Brown. And that's rather tragic. And it does not bode well for the lawyers for Michael Brown, because you have to make these applications. at every stage. None of that has happened yet. Now we are at a stage where we just witnessed Bob McCullough engaging in all his madness in terms of the grand jury, and instead of lawyers doing research for a motion to quash the grand jury results, these lawyers are out there doing press conferences. You know, and so what we see is lawyers, along with Al Sharpton, talking about things outside of the courthouse, not inside the courthouse, where these things take place. They're taking place outside of the courthouse. And that's why black people don't understand that it's not what people say, but where do they say it? If they are saying things, but they are saying things outside of the judicial forum where those statements should be made, then you are being scammed yourself. And so my point is, now we're waiting for the lawyers to make that application, because the reality of it is, it does get trickier if you are going to initiate a civil rights action. However, why should you have to go through that when you're still entitled to a grand jury investigation, which did not take place? And now you have enough evidence to show that that should be squashed. So one thing that you might consider instead of all of that is to make a motion to move to squash the whole grand jury result, showing all kinds of improprieties of which judge are empowered to have to address, and then see what the outcome of that is. And, you know, and then later you can start talking about whether the federal government should get involved. But now we have a clear case of Missouri not allowing for transparency. And the reason I say that is because, you see, there are two types of grand juries. There is the investigatory grand jury, and then there is the charging grand jury. Now, the charging grand jury dispenses with the actual process of an investigation, because the charging grand jury already have information available that would establish probable cause. And that's all the Constitution requires, is probable cause. Once probable cause is established, and once you want to continue the process of arresting the person who committed the crime and arraigning that person, that's what you're going to do. You're going to call for that. Now, what we had in this case, in Michael Brown, is an investigatory grand jury. However, what McCullough did at the end of the entire presentation made the entire presentation a farce, because while he told us that he had to have a investigatory grand jury, he turned around, and therefore he had to enjoy secrecy, he turned around after having done all of that and then publicized everything that the grand jury did. So what was the purpose of the investigatory grand jury if it was not to manufacture the evidence that would allow for Darren Wilson to walk away from this case?
But apart from that, we still are perplexed. I mean, you called it an investigatory grand jury, but it seems this is a hybrid. This is a new category altogether. Every legal authority I've read said they're not sure what this was.
But this is what I said. I said there are only two kinds of grand jury. I didn't say anything about a hybrid, even though it turned out to be a hybrid. I said there was only two types. Now, you're correct in saying that this was a hybrid, but I did not say that, because it does not allow for a hybrid grand jury. All right, but you're absolutely correct when you say that it was a hybrid grand jury, and that is where the problem lies.
Coming back to this federal investigation and the potential of the federal investigation to pursue an indictment on civil rights grounds, we don't have a very good track record of the federal government producing results on in that regard, do we?
Well, the reason why we don't have a good track record, because the federal government decides when it wants to deviate from stare decisis, which is supposed to be the guiding principle in litigation. In other words, every case builds on the prior case, and so they become one body of law. And so here you have a situation where there are deviations from that, depending upon what the circumstances are, and that is where the violation of law comes about. Because if we were going to deal with stare decisis, we would then look at what happened with Yanker Rosenbaum and Limerick Nelson, and then try to explain why we can't do the same thing in Michael Brown that we did in Yanker Rosenbaum. And you can't offer no explanation. You can't offer a legal explanation. And that's where the problem is. The problem is that the U.S. Justice Department picks and chooses when it wants to follow the law and when it doesn't want to follow the law.
Well, I am also looking at the, especially because it applies to Eric Holder himself, I keep going back to the Amadou Diallo case of 1999, where there were no indictments there, although one would see, I mean, one would say that on the basis of the facts as they were, that it was mind-boggling that no indictments were produced in that case.
Well, it was mind-boggling because of the fact that, I mean, well, let's say there were no indictments at the federal level. Right. There was, you know, indictments at the state level, and those indictments went into a state prosecution. The problem with the state prosecution was is that the governor of New York usurped the authority of the judicial system, which is supposed to be separate and apart from the executive branch of government, and use his own or abuse his own legal authority to dismiss the black judge who was supposed to be presiding over the case, and then placing the jury trial in Albany County, which was right next door to his office, so he could have take a look and keep an eye on what the state jury was doing in Albany County. And that should have given rise to the federal government saying, hey, wait a minute, this can't be done. And so, you know, for that reason alone, we're going to step into the Amadou Diallo case and indict these cops, because we see that the remedies on the state level are not going to be exercised, and therefore it is appropriate for there to be federal intervention.
Could you explain, though, because this is an elusive concept to me, the civil rights issue. How does prosecution, criminal prosecution of civil rights, what is the threshold of proof or standard of proof that is required at the federal level that is different from what is required at the state level? Civil rights versus on the federal level versus the prosecution of the same charge at the state level.
Well, the difference is this. On the state level, legislators and the legislatures basically deal with laws coming out of the common law. And so that's basically, laws that affect everybody in a particular way. Now, when we came out of slavery, the government initially said we are supposed to be the special preference of the law. The special preference of the law. We're supposed to get preferential treatment in the way that we have to live as a way of compensating for our enslavement, partly under the slave codes and otherwise under the U.S. Constitution for a long period of time. And so, therefore, there was crafted a new body of law called civil rights, which had been unknown to American jurisprudence before then. And as a result of this new body of law, we were supposed to receive special preferences under it. Of course, that never happened because the Confederate States of America, which was the Confederacy, entered into an agreement, explicit agreement, before or in 1877, that the special treatment of blacks has to come to an end. And Chief Associate Justice Bradley, who was part of the Electoral Commission for the Compromise of 1877, went back to the U.S. Supreme Court and began to invalidate the civil rights of blacks, starting with the noted civil rights cases of 1883. And so from that point on up to 1954, we were absolutely getting no relief in terms of the meaning of the 14th Amendment. And now in retrospect, we have to wonder whether the Supreme Court did the right thing in deciding Brown versus Board of Education.
So here we have a cleavage then of, and this is what I'm trying to get at, even as they admit that this special body of law pertains to the people of African ancestry, the descendants of slaves, we still have the dichotomy here of natural law versus natural rights versus civil rights.
Yeah, well, we do, but we don't have it in the sense that, you know, we do have it in practice. I mean, so there's no question about that. But the point that was made during Reconstruction was that in addition to these natural rights, there also have to be civil rights as added protections. And so, you know, we were supposed to have a fallback position where, you know, if things didn't work out for whatever reason under natural rights, then civil rights was supposed to be the safety net. What we found out is that there's no net at all. And so this is where the problem is. And then the other problem is, and I say this all the time, and that is that law schools were never established to represent descendants of enslaved Africans or slaves themselves. I mean, that was not the point of going to a law school. So since that was not the point of going to law schools, there are no law schools who teach today how black attorneys or any other attorneys should represent black defendants. There's no law school at all that teaches that. So, you know, what happens is that these lawyers that come out now, like Holder, you know, who went to Columbia, don't have the foggiest notion of what he should be doing in representing black people. You know, and, you know, and the reason why my whole study was a lot better was not because I'm smarter, but because I was started at the University of Georgia Law School, which was founded by the Carr brothers, who are the architects of the Confederate States of America. And so the training that I got at the University of Georgia made me sensitive to what this whole problem was about. And so, you know, when I finally came to Harlem, I began to work on a textbook on how to represent the black defender. And, you know, I ended up writing that textbook and using it at the National Conference of Black Lawyers. But then the process of me using it at the National Conference of Black Lawyers, and before that was actual computers, you know, one day I looked up, I was representing Coalition for the Schomburg because they were trying to put a white archivist in there. And lo and behold, the National Conference of Black Lawyers got pressure, and they not only kicked me out, but they padlocked the doors and put security guards in front of the building and said, if you come here again, you will be arrested. Now, you know, finally, when I went back eventually to look for all the work that I had done, nobody could find it. So, you know, this is the sad part about our community is that there's no way that we protect people who are trying to serve us. And so it would have been a milestone if I could have done that. Now, why I have been successful is because I did write the textbook. I understand the text. and I understand how you do it. But that wasn't why I was doing it. I was doing it to help other lawyers, you know, to cut down on this prison industrial complex, which is the exception to the 13th Amendment.
Well, I didn't mean to laugh, but, you know, the way you put it, it was... I've known you for so many years, and this is, you know, people may think that this is really awful in your view, but this is actually validation of the work that you have been doing all these many years, always confronting a system, not at all expecting that they would take lightly to the kind of work that you do, but this is what you have been doing for all these many years. And you take it, you know, as part of the landscape. It's part of your landscape. People may think, my gosh, what? That is not funny. Well, it's not regular humor. It is more an expression of irony than anything else. Now, going forward here, we have this federal investigation pending on civil rights, possible civil rights prosecution, and possibly also taking a look at the systemic problems of the functions of the police department in Ferguson. So we'll see how that goes. But many of the people involved in these cases, in this case in Ferguson, also are involved in the case, in the chokehold case of Eric Garner in New York City. I'm talking the same lawyers, Crump and others, and his partners. We have Al Sharpton, and we have Eric Holder to some degree also involved there. Given what has happened in Ferguson with this grand jury, is it a harbinger for what is going to happen in the Staten Island case?
Well, there's no question about it. It's a harbinger, but I think the other side of it is it's incumbent upon our community to support those persons who have supported the community. And, you know, and the problem that we have is that we do not have legal representation, and that we don't have a group, starting with my own organization of United African Movement or the Freedom Party, that is prepared to stand behind somebody and make sure that these things happen. Because when we look at the chokehold death of Eric Garner, there has been no demands placed on Andrew Cuomo at all. And so he's at free range to let the district attorney out in Staten Island to do whatever he so pleases. And that is exactly what he's doing. And for people who are not really familiar with the New York City area, of the five boroughs, without question, Staten Island has a reputation of being the most racist of those five boroughs. And so if there was ever need for anybody to monitor what was going on, it would definitely be a need to monitor that in Staten Island. And I say that based up not only on reputation, but on experience, because I've tried some major cases out in Staten Island. And I can tell you for sure that the judges out there routinely deviate from the U.S. Constitution in applying the law of to any criminal defendant who is a descendant of enslaved Africans.
Well, certainly the case so far and the actions of the district attorney so far are quite troubling, because here, again, we have no idea how this so-called special grand jury had been convened. We're not aware that it was an order from the state attorney general that a special grand jury should be convened, that there was a green light given, and that is a process. That is not just a DA getting up and saying, hey, I have a special grand jury convened over here, and we're about to embark on our business. So that has not been clarified at all. So are you clear about what kind of grand jury is actually operating in Staten Island?
Well, I tell you what I am clear about. No, I'm not clear about that, but I tell you what I am clear about. I am clear about the fact that people are running around talking about body cameras today, and we just had a body camera in the chokehold death of Eric Garner. And the videographer, the person who took the tape of the chokehold death, and there's enough evidence there to show that Eric Garner was chokehold, this person on the second day of August, a couple weeks after the chokehold death of Eric Garner, Ramsey Orter was himself arrested falsely as a retaliation for what he had done in recording and videotaping the chokehold death of Eric Garner. And so, and what makes this ironic is that on August 1st of this year, the medical examiner's office came back with the finding that his death, meaning Garner's death, should be classified as a homicide. So now you have the two elements of probable cause that are necessary to arrest the cop. You have, on one hand, you got the whole camera shooting of the cop choking Eric Garner to death. And on the other hand, you have the medical examiner saying that this should be classified as a crime. So now the probable cause has been established, because you know that a crime was established and that the cop was the one who probably caused the death. Now, instead of going out on the first day of August and arresting the cop now, since we've been waiting for somebody, for all this to happen, the New York Police Department instead turns around and arrests Ramsey Orter. And so when Ramsey Orter is arrested, he's out there, and Sharpton, the National Action Network, all these people claim that they are supposed to be down with the chokehold death of Eric Garner being aggrieved, they instead refuses to have anything to do with Ramsey Orter. And then after that, you have Letitia James, who turns around and talk about, well, we need body cameras, but we also need a protection of a witness. You know, so what about Ramsey Orter? You know, and so now we have a situation where nobody is addressing Ramsey Orter, and he is now subject to an indictment, and his next court case is on the 22nd of January, 2015, and I have tried to do everything I could do without the support of the community to stand up and represent this man. The question becomes, you know, what kind of support are we talking about here? And for some people who talk about, well, you know, my representative said this or that about you, well, my response to your representative saying this or that about Alton Maddox is this. What case do you know of that a lawyer has been pushed out of the courtroom when the lawyer has never been convicted of a crime, when the lawyer has never received a complaint from a client that the disciplinary committee thought was worthy of any kind of investigation? And when have a lawyer been charged not by a client but by a New York legislature, which under the U.S. Constitution amounts to a bill of attainder? And so the question becomes, where is the black community in terms of supporting me? Because obviously New York has a real problem with me ever going back in the courtroom again, but that's New York's problem. That shouldn't be your problem. You know, I don't know how Negroes are, well, we got a problem too. No, that's his problem. That he should have that problem, you know, because he doesn't want any case that he indicts, he doesn't want to lose it. So he has that problem. But for you to think that you got a similar problem, you know, I'm sitting over there at UAM, and Negroes over there talking about, well, we got a problem too. Wait a minute. I was the one that founded this organization. You know, we got a problem in the Freedom Party. Wait a minute. I was the one that founded this organization. How do you become it caught up in his problem rather than my problem? And that's what we got to address here in New York City.
I want to talk about this business of probable cause. Is it the grand jury's job to determine probable cause, or is it not the prosecutor's job to establish probable cause for arrest?
Well, there are two things that people got to understand about prosecutors. prosecutors do not investigate cases. So if you have a case in which probable cause is put on the table while you're sitting there for dinner, then you act on that because, you know, it's right there. I mean, you're not allowed to investigate a case, but it's right there in front of your eyes. It's in plain view. So that's when a charging grand jury comes into play, because now somebody just dumped that in your face. I mean, you know, like, okay, here's the videotape of Eric Garner. Here is the autopsy report of Eric Garner. The videotape by order, around the order. The autopsy of Eric Garner. Well, that's on the plate. So, you know, in that case, you don't have to investigate at all. You just simply say, I'm going to call a charging grand jury in here to bring about the indictment. It ain't no difficult process. Don't take but a minute to indict somebody. You know, that's why they say a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. Don't take but a minute. Because once you get those two things, you have probable cause, and therefore you begin to move. Same thing out there in Missouri with Darren Wilson. If Bob McCullough had been an uninterested prosecutor, then when he was sitting at lunch or dinner and somebody on one hand dropped some names of some witnesses on his plate, and then on the other hand they dropped the autopsy report of the victim in that particular case, then the prosecutor said, well, hey, I got enough to order a charging grand jury. And so the grand jury come in, and in a minute, he's indicted. Now, what you have in Ferguson is what you correctly refer to as a hybrid, because on one hand, McCullough brings in a investigatory grand jury and tell us that it's necessary to protect secrecy in order for him to do his job. And then, on the other hand, he turns around and on the very day that the grand jury said we don't have enough evidence, he turns around and said, well, we don't need secrecy no more, so I'm going to disclose everything. You can't do it that way. Because it's a crime to do what he did in Missouri and everywhere else. You can't disclose information once you decide that it has to go through a investigatory grand jury. If you want to disclose information under those circumstances, you have to make an application to the court, which he did not do. He just simply did it on his own, which shows you he has no regard for the law at all. Therefore, all of that should be in a motion that these lawyers should be doing rather than doing a press conferences all over the place and going into a federal court and say it is very clear that the state of Missouri does not have any intentions to protect the rights of descendants of enslaved Africans. We have impleaded the Justice Department now. We filed a petition to implead the Justice Department to come into the case. The Justice Department then has to come in and they have to show, well, why they can't take it over. That's what they have to show, why we can't take it over. And when they can't show that, the judge has to say, well, you know what? I'm ordering you to continue this civil rights investigation and to prosecute if it's appropriate in this particular case. See, so all of these other barriers, you know, nobody's addressing them because we automatically going from what McCullough's did the other night to immediately talking about a civil rights prosecution without anybody asking any questions in the meantime or anybody seeking any judicial review of what happened in the meantime, because judicial review is very appropriate. And there is no bar to a second grand jury looking at the case, and there is no bar to a federal government looking at a case because the Fifth Amendment Double Jeopardy Clause does not apply to grand jury investigations.
Well, I asked the question because among the statements that he made was that the grand jury found no probable cause in order to persuade them to issue an indictment. So the question was, did he also yield that burden to the grand jury, the burden of, as prosecutor, first, the assumption being, by the time a case comes to the grand jury, one would assume that probable cause has already been established and by the prosecutor. But when he said that the grand jury found no probable cause in its deliberations to issue an indictment, it seemed to suggest that even that responsibility he yielded to the grand jury.
Well, he did. He abdicated his constitutional obligation because the grand jury, in the absence of knowing why it was there, decided to do nothing. You have a situation where grand juries are led by prosecutors who tell them why they are there. You know, so if Utrecht Lee was sitting in the hot seat, I can guarantee you they would say, well, reason why we're here today, because she got a loud mouth, she don't know how to stay in her place, and we need to put her on the hot seat. Well, then they know what to do. But when you just say, well, we're here, you know, just enjoy yourself for a few days, cool out, have a vacation, and do whatever you want to do, well, that's what they did. At the end of the day, they don't have an obligation to do anything. Nobody asked them to do anything. You can't do it that way. That's the reason why I said before, brother, these lawyers running around here now, kicking up their heels, you know, and doing press conferences and all of that madness that they're doing now, that somebody should remind them that as officers of the court, they're supposed to be making a motion for judicial review. And I'm saying that under a motion for judicial review, either one or two things are going to happen. You're going to either have a second grand jury, or secondly, you're going to implead the federal government to get on this job of initiating a federal civil rights action. And my point is, when Al Sharpton is running with the hares and hunting with the hounds, that needs to tell you that he has a conflict of interest himself as a rainmaker, and therefore what his job is really to do is to protect the Obama administration from having any responsibility for protecting our lives.
Could you give us an idea of what you're thinking in terms of the legal implications here for the next round? We are expecting soon to have a determination of the Staten Island grand jury as to the outcome in the Garner case, whether there will be charges filed against any or all of the officers involved. What should assuming that there is an interest in being preemptive about this, but on the part of the lawyers, what should they be preparing for now, and how should they be preparing?
Well, in terms of the Garner case, what they should have done, I mean, once the district attorney out there said that, you know, he was going to start this investigation, they should have immediately filed a challenge to the array of the grand jury. That's a very basic step in terms of a grand jury investigation, and that is, we want the jury, commission of jurors, to come in and tell us how this process went about. I have done that out in Staten Island. I filed motions to challenge the array of the grand jury and challenge the array of the petit jury. And so I can tell you that it has not been nice in terms of what I found out. Now, back then when I was trying cases, I can tell you that, you know, the people in Staten Island don't have any interest in adhering to the procedure of law in terms of how grand jurors are to be chosen. And I don't believe that they have come into any new enlightenment now as to what should be done. And so I can only expect in a county in which most of the people out there are members of law enforcement agencies themselves, or related to members of law enforcement agencies, that they would do what one would normally expect, and that is to return a no true bill in the death of Eric Garner.
But is that's it our too late?
Because we're not any demands.
Is it too late for any interventive action before the grand jury makes its decision?
No, it will only be too late if you sit here and you decide that you're not going to do anything today or tomorrow in terms of getting somebody out there who can represent you. It's too late if you decide, well, tonight, this Wednesday night, I'm going to have myself some fun rather than to go out to a forum where this issue might be entertained and where we can try to deal with some results. So as long as the grand jury is still investigating, and I will imagine now, given the fact that this is, quote, Thanksgiving, close quote, that's really be taking place anyway until Monday. So we at least have a small window of opportunity to get busy.
What will be the nature of the intervention that would be effective in this case in Staten Island?
The nature of the intervention is the fact that once a lawyer is involved, and I think this is what's important, and this is an important concept that we don't seem to understand. We always talk about, well, we want to see what the family of Michael Brown says, and we want to respect their wishes. Well, the law doesn't care what Michael Brown's family says or any other victim's family. You know, they don't respect that. Black folks respect that, but nobody else respect that, because in a criminal case, the caption of the case in New York will read people versus whoever, which means that the people themselves have the standing. And therefore, if a person in this state believes that something is going awry, then they will retain a lawyer who will make a motion to intervene and then say to the judge, wait a minute, judge, you got to be responsible for this one way or the other, because we don't believe certain steps have been taken, and we believe that this whole process is bogus, and we think you should stop it now and save the taxpayer some dollars. I mean, that's how the process works. But if you don't have a lawyer who is going to stand up for you and who instead is trying to rub shoulders and rub arms with the power establishment, you know, we got a problem. And that's what we got to understand. This is a class action. Eric Garner is a class action because it is a action against a class. And the class is us. It's all of us, not some of us, all of us. And we ought to also understand that there are no innocent bystanders in a class action. In other words, whether you think it or not, hey, you're involved because you're a member of the class. You know, you can't exclude yourself from something that's already been defined for you. So, you know, you can abdicate your responsibility, but there is a responsibility on the part of everybody in a class to be active in that class. And so with that, you know, we all have a vested interest. We all have standing to complain about this process.
Well, we know so far that the lawyers only now are saying, you know, they've come back and said after this grand jury decision in Ferguson that they, of course, are opposed to it, and they consider the process unfair, and they consider the process to have been rigged, etc. But, you know, it's crying after spilt milk. They had more than enough time, and they had more than enough suspicion about the process to have acted in a preemptive way, and they absolutely failed to do that.
That's absolutely correct.
So it makes no sense now to be calling about, you know, quarreling and carping about how unfair the process is. If you absented yourself from the fray, why now, after everything has gone exactly as was predicted? I'm not a lawyer, and I did it on, what, August the 19th? We discussed right here on the show that this is how the case was going to go, based on the body of evidence in cases like this and how they typically had gone. And this was going to be no exception. Anybody following these kinds of cases would not at all be surprised at the way it went.
That's absolutely correct. And therefore, the next question that everybody who's listening to this and everybody else who has an interest in to this should be asking to everybody, what is your next legal step? Because there are legal steps available. Now, whether you want to park out and do none of these things, that's your business. But these legal steps are available. And that's what we know. We also know for every wrong, there is a right. That's in the legal. That's in American jurisprudence. For every wrong, there's a right. And what is your legal step in correcting those wrongs?
Well, I want to thank you so much, Alton, for being with us today and for, again, bringing even more light on these issues. I want to say, though, to you and to those listening, you would notice that on this program, the kind of information that has been shared with you, you're not going to get this anyplace else at all. And so far, I haven't. I've been looking at how this case is being covered. Nobody is even coming close to these kinds of questions. And yet, this is the fundamental approach to understanding not only Ferguson, but the Fergusons of America.
Well, that's true, Eutrice, and I think it's appropriate on Thanksgiving for us to start giving thanks to those who are defending our positions. And so certainly one of those big thanks is to you, because you don't have to do this. You know, you're making that a step in which you're not required to do. And anybody want to sit here and not recognize there's a big difference between this program and any other programs out of their minds. And so we should give thanks to those who want to defend us. We should also support those who want to defend us. Otherwise, what is there for us to complain about? We know the landscape. We know what people are doing. We know there are ambulance chasers out here. We know there are sellouts out here. Rather than to identify and complain about them, why don't we replace those sellouts with somebody who really has the heart of the community in mind?
Well, I know you've discussed this, thank you, and I know you've discussed this on your own website. Could you share your website so people can go and read some more?
Well, I certainly can, because I think that's absolutely critical. www.reinstatealtonmatics.com. www.reinstatealtonmatics.com. Because what I'm writing now is your basic training 101 for other cases, in addition to Michael Brown, but cases like the case of Eric Garner and the case of Akiah Gurley over in Brooklyn. Because we need some basic training. What I'm suggesting to the Freedom Party to do is to sponsor an all-day workshop on basic training 101. That means that they will sponsor it and provide for it, because we can't go forward unless and until we are quite clear on how we must fight. There's a war going on. We know that. We just heard a minister now from Ferguson say his church was burned down, which is one of the tactics of the Ku Klux Klan. These people are serious. The question is, how serious are we?
Thanks, Alton, again for being with us. And
thank
it
you,
applies
you
to you, too. Thank you for the work you have done all these many years. Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you.
This brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it shed even more light on this particular subject, which is constantly evolving. But it arms you with the fundamentals in a way that most people will not have to really understand how these things work and why there is a systemic problem, because it has been systemically designed this way. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Economic Update with Jack Rasmus. You can reach me via email at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. Of course, tomorrow is Thanksgiving Day for those of you who celebrate it. But whether you do or not, try and take it easy tomorrow with people who are close to you and people all those two, and enjoy their company, enjoy the company of family and friends, and we'll come back to your thoughts and freeing your mind on Friday. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. So we'll hear you on Friday. Bye-bye.